Welcome to This Is Money Show. I'm Georgie Frost, and in the studio with me is editor Simon Lambert and consumer affairs editor Lee Boyce to round up the week's top stories they've been covering on their award-winning website. And this week, bad banks are back. On what is said to be the 10th anniversary of the financial crisis, the boss of bailed out RBS says victims of fraud should not expect automatic refunds. But are banks doing enough to track down the perpetrators? One man says no and took matters into his own hands. Also, I know we've heard this before, but is this really the last chance to grab a cheap mortgage? Category D vehicles, a car crash buy or a great deal? We also take a look at the 10 best hybrid cars on sale today, answer the prayers of anyone who's ever dreamt of investing in cows. I mean, who hasn't? Plus, a favourite of pub quizzes up and down the land. I'm taking a run up to this. Philatelists? Has Lee's childhood pursuits made him a millionaire? Spoiler alert, he's in the studio, so it's very doubtful. All that and plenty more coming up. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. But first, a rather arresting front page of the Mail this week. Sure to make the blood boil, I imagine, lads, of anyone who's been the victim of bank fraud. Me. Twice in the last 9 months. And indeed, anyone who hasn't, because let's be honest, we are all at increasing risk. Well, when asked whether bailed out RBS, which owns, of course, NatWest and has 24 million customers, had a duty of care to victims, well, the boss, Ross McEwan, replied, no. It was not the responsibility of banks when customers give their account details or money to online scammers, he said, and it would be too costly to cover all the losses. Instead, we need to be more careful. But are the banks themselves doing enough? They repeatedly tell us they are. One scammed man says that is simply not true and he had to take matters into his own hands. Lee, the scam man Boyce, is here, thankfully. Does Mr. McEwan have a point? What is going on here? Are we just being careless? Is that the issue?
I laughed so much at that. It was just a one line quote and it said no. It was just no. There was no explanation to it.
Unequivocal.
No. Well, look, this is something that's been going on for a number of years now. I remember the chief police guy last year came out and said something quite similar, but it's quite different when a boss of a major bank comes out and says something like that. Last year, I, part of a fraud investigation, actually asked for figures from banks, how many frauds actually get investigated, and NatWest are the only ones that came back and said actually 70% don't. So, you know, 70% of fraud that it's getting, it's not looking into. It's probably just getting deluged for all of these banks.
If they're not looking into it, what are they doing? Are they automatically refunding? Are they just saying,
Well, to be honest with you, it's quite hard to tell because it's such a closed book, all of this scam stuff. You know, banks don't really want to give out much information as to how many scams and how many fraud reports they're getting each week because it looks like a weakness, doesn't it, if your bank's getting more than other banks. But look, as a voice of reason and someone that has covered all frauds and scams, you know, involving banks over the years, pretty much we have covered every scam going. And I've always said that in some cases, I understand a bank's point of view. It can't be a viable business if it just dishes out refunds willy-nilly all the time for every single fraud. It does make people lethargic when it comes to their own defences and stopping themselves becoming a victim of fraud. However, that said, some fraud is completely not people's fault. They haven't done anything. And it's quite heartbreaking if it all gets clubbed into that kind of zone where it's like, you know, we've had all sorts of really quite clued up people that have fallen victims of fraud. And these fraudsters become more and more sophisticated as the years go by. And people are getting tricked by it. And that's what I don't like. If it's something that's really cut and dry, if you really have done something which a reasonable person wouldn't do, then I can kind of understand. But then you've got to start thinking about vulnerable people and elderly people who, you know, are quite often the victims. And some people, you know, lose thousands, hundreds of thousands of pounds. You can imagine how, I just can't imagine being in that situation to lose that kind of money. Banks are trying to draw a line and say, this stuff has now been out in the open for a long time, you know, all of these different types of scams, and you should have a duty of care to govern yourself. But at the end of the day, if the bank can't prove that you've acted fraudulently or you've not acted negligently, I don't see how it could block you from ever having a refund.
Well, that's it, isn't it? The regulations in the UK state that banks can only refuse to refund a customer if he or she has acted fraudulently or has been grossly negligent, and the onus is on them to prove it.
Exactly. So that's, you know, we're going to talk about a couple of cases in a minute where I feel that, you know, in neither of these cases, that's happened. And actually, the banks are you know, really sort of pulling up the drawbridge and going, well, you know, it's a shame, but it's your fault.
What annoyed me about my particular case, it's all about me, Liz. No, but what you mentioned there about transparency, and last time we spoke about this, you got more irate than I did about the fact that I hadn't been told why the same thing had happened twice in 9 months. I had to cancel my card both times, and I'm still none the wiser about what went wrong. But to be fair to my bank, they refunded really without any question at all. It was very, 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 very easy. But Simon?
Well, the crucial difference is basically whether someone defrauds you by cloning your card, using your details, hacking into you, versus if you transfer the money to somewhere else.
So there's
and as
there's
Lee was saying, this is where they're washing their hands of the situation. If you transfer the money to someone else, the banks are saying, you transferred the money, it's your fault. Now, I understand that position, because what they're saying is we can't protect you from everything. But what they're saying is the logical extension of that is anything that happened where you paid someone some money who was a con man, we'd be on the hook for. And you can't expect us to be in that position. And what these tricks are, where they basically convince you to send your money to someone else, is essentially an old-fashioned contract. They pretend to be someone else. However, what we have seen time and time again is people knowing certain details about people's finances that you think, well, how did they know that? People impersonating people's banks on the telephone, people calling back what they think is their bank on the telephone, people knowing when big payments are going into their accounts. Lee investigated a series of cases where farmers who had just received large payments, was it their agricultural
EU subsidies,
policy, EU subsidies, were being tapped up. Now, how do they know that that money's gone in? Also, scenarios where people just might not have been expected to know that they weren't talking to their bank. And we campaigned quite heavily on this. We wanted the banks to be warning people much more strongly about this. And we got somewhere. But those warnings are not big enough. We've discussed this before. When you go onto your internet banking page, there is a little bit on the payment page that says, don't transfer this money to someone if you don't know them, kind of thing. There is no safe account. We don't do that kind of thing. But where's the letter from your bank that says in big letters, fraudsters are scamming people by pretending to be your bank or pretending to be your builder or pretending to be your solicitor. Do not transfer them money. What they're not doing is publicising it enough. There's a few advertising campaigns going on.
Barclays.
I have seen
They've
Barclays, yeah, so fair
years.
Enough. But there is nowhere near enough effort being put into this to warn customers if the banks want to then put all of the liability onto them. So if the banks want to put all of the liability onto customers, they can't just rely on those customers having read a story about this kind of thing happening on This Is Money or on one of our other rival financial publications. The banks need to be out there proactively warning them and getting their staff to pick up on it on the telephone and in all other things and watching out for suspicious patterns. And time again, we see that that is not happening properly. So when I hear comments like, you can't expect us to refund customers when they've been scammed in this way, ultimately I have no sympathy with that position, because I don't think the banks are doing enough to protect their customers, because it's the banking system that is being used to facilitate these crimes. And the other thing that we'll get onto in a minute is there is a suspicion that the banks are not doing enough to try and track down the money after you have transferred it, because ultimately you have transferred that money to another bank, to another bank account, and that other bank account has someone behind it. And they may have then dispersed that from that other bank account, which is the excuse the banks give. But all of those dispersions will be to another bank account. You know that old phrase, follow the money? It doesn't seem to us like the banks are doing enough of following the money.
I think with regards to Mr. McEwen in the comments, it sticks in the craw a bit that it was RBS boss that said it. But, Lee, you mentioned earlier the case of hero Gideon Roseman. What a name.
It's a great name,
isn't it?
Yeah.
What happened here?
This was one of these scams that we've seen arising in recent times. So he was getting some building work done. Received an email from the builder saying, you know, this is my account details. So he transferred over £21,000 for the building work, or £20,000 for the building work. Shortly afterwards, the builder got in touch with all of his clients and said, my email was hacked. Ignore this email that's been sent out. Unfortunately, the money had already been transferred over. So the penny dropped for Mr. Roseman. He realised that straight away that it was a scam and that the money had gone. But that's not Mr. Roseman's fault, is it? I mean, at the end of the day, the email's come through. He's had a quote through from the builder. He's been talking to the builder on the email. There's no reason to believe that that's not his bank details. So it's very difficult for the bank to put the onus on him. So anyway, he took matters into his own hands, which I absolutely love this story, by the way. It's fantastic. You know, I really do think he is a bit of a hero here for actually proving what we've long suspected in the fact that banks aren't doing all that they can.
He is a barrister. We should point this out. So he's well skilled in this.
He's well skilled in this. And some of this is what he's done is a little bit technical. It is a little bit complicated. But to put it in a sort of layman's terms and keep it quite simple, he went to London. Mm-hmm. He went to High Court to apply for the fraudster's bank account to be frozen. So when the money's gone, he's asked for that account to be frozen. That stops the money being able to be moved around. Unfortunately, the money had already been moved out of the account anyway, but the fraudster got back in touch and he played along for a little bit and said, oh no, this is another account, you know, blah blah blah. He got that one frozen. He asked again for the High Court to have the information about these bank accounts to try and track down who it was that stolen the money. So he'd done that. From that, so he was a Santander customer. He actually managed to prove that Barclays had delayed. He'd phoned Barclays in the first instance. That's the first thing he did, phone bank, being victim of
top
fraud.
Tip, yeah.
Yeah, top tip. You've got to do it. So £9,150 was transferred out of the fraudster's account more than 24 hours after he first reported the incident to Barclays. So how? How have Barclays not stopped that from
immediately
happening? You know, so by proving that, by getting those bank statements, and it's only because he went through the High Court to get those statements. Otherwise, banks are very tight-lipped. If you phoned up your bank or the bank where the money's gone, they're going to say, well, data protection, can't tell you this, can't tell you that, but, you know, we're looking into it and we're trying to sort it out for you. Which is just now proven to be a load of rubbish. And because he's had these statements and he's been able to prove, hey, you've done nothing to freeze this money and stop this money. I've had to go and freeze the account by going to the High Court. Barclays had to turn around and refund him, you know, that
£9,000. They give him some compensation as well.
And they give him some compensation, yeah, £200 compensation.
We praise Barclays now, we're having to take that away a little bit.
Yeah, well, no, to be honest with you, I'm not going to praise him at all. Why are they not doing their jobs? Why is that account still active? How are these accounts being opened by fraudsters in the first place? What's been doing to stop all of this from happening and this vicious cycle of fraud from happening? It doesn't feel like a lot. You can put some glossy TV adverts out there, but it's still not going to stop all of it from happening.
Go Lee. Go on, son. Go Lee. Because we have another case, so I'll let you calm down and Simon can talk about that unless you really want to do this, Lee.
I've calmed down. Yeah.
Perfect. Another one here. Fraudsters stole £3,140 from my current account via 18 cash machine withdrawals. But Santander this time won't refund me despite CCTV evidence.
This case is, I mean, the thing is, I'm getting contacted about four cases, left, right, and centre, Georgia. I'm having all sorts of, like, crazy cases. You think, how on earth has this happened? And this is one of this. This is a real Sherlock Holmes case, this one. So Mr. Patel, the reader in question, had the 123 current account and used it purely as a savings account because a lot of people did that. This fraud happened while it was still paying 3% on balances up to £20,000. So he's using it as a savings account. He's not particularly looking at it as you might do with your current account, you know, looking at statements every day, looking into, you know, going on your online banking. So he didn't spot it for a little while. Anyway, he finally had a statement through, looked through it and saw some suspicious withdrawals from Barclays near him and a Crosscutter ATM. Money is coming out of sort of £100 or £250 bursts. So he was aware, well, that wasn't me. He'd used the card once to get a visa, I think, at the Indian embassy. So he'd used it once and that's it. He just been locked in a safe, didn't need it for anything. So it was locked in a safe, right? So anyway, he got in touch with Santander. They said, well, you know, it's your fault. You know, someone must have had your PIN or must have had your card. He's like, you know, the card's been locked in a safe and the only person that knows the PIN is me. How's this happened?
Yeah, how?
And then Santander was saying, well, you know, you couldn't have been shoulder surfed, so that's where someone stands behind you, claims your card, stands behind you and gets your PIN number. I'm still none the wiser as to how this fraud's happened, but Santander have said, we're not refunding. So takes it to the financial ombudsman. Ombudsman says, well, we can't find Santander at fault. Well, well done, ombudsman. That's great, isn't it? Because that's really adhering to the banking regulations that you talked about earlier about has the customer acted negligently? Oh, I can't see if he's left a card in the safe. And has he acted fraudulently? Well, he got in touch with the Metropolitan Police, who got CCTV footage of some of these cash withdrawals happening because there's a timestamp on the statement from which cash machine it is. Yeah. So Metropolitan Police got involved. I've said, well, it's no one that you know, and it's various people were taking this money out of this cash machine somehow. police, get in touch with Santander, send the evidence over, but that still meant nothing to them. I'm not even convinced they've seen, looked at the footage. I've asked numerous times if that footage was studied, and the bank just didn't answer.
All right, well, I'm going to read out the statement for fairness here that they told you that this is money. Mr. Patel first raised this complaint with us in November 2015. Following an initial investigation, we turned down his claim and after an appeal reached the same conclusion. In 2016, further investigations were carried out following new contact from Mr. Patel and the claim was again declined in December 2016. Mr. Patel then contacted the FOS, whose adjudication agreed with our findings. The money has not been refunded to Mr. Patel as there is no feasible explanation as to how a third party could have obtained both his card and PIN without his knowledge. Mr. Patel kept his card in a locked safe, which only he and his wife had access to. His PIN was not written down and it had only ever been shared with his wife. Additionally, Mr. Patel did not use his card, so there would have been no opportunity for shoulder surfing. We have investigated this case thoroughly and are satisfied with our conclusions. If Mr. Patel has further evidence, we will happily look at it. Right, I've read that out. I've written it down. I've read that out again. They say that they've investigated the case thoroughly, but I can't see that there's a conclusion here. To me, no. I mean, am I wrong in thinking that? Have I missed a line in that?
Do you know what I feel like in this instance? It's almost like he's guilty before he's proven innocent, and he's having to prove his innocence. Well, the owner shouldn't be that. You know, the bank has to say, we're going to refund you, unless it can prove he has acted fraudulently or he's acted negligently. Where's the proof? How are they proving that he's done either of those two things? If they've got proof of it, they've not told me what it is, either in that statement or off the record.
Simon, have you ever heard a case like this?
Yeah, I have done before. We've had instances before where the bank has turned around to us and off the record said, not this particular bank, but a bank has turned around to us and off the record said, you can't believe this person's story. We've looked into this and we honestly don't think they're telling the truth. Sometimes you have to just take that at face value. You know, obviously we have a relationship with the PR departments of the banks and I trust them to be honest with us, especially if they're saying to us, like, this is not for print, this is totally off the record. But in this instance, Lee said that Santander haven't tried to explain to them that anything like that has gone on. So it has literally become a he said, she said scenario. The only logical conclusion you can draw from what the bank is saying is that they're saying that the victim is lying. And the only logical conclusion you can draw from the victim is that he's telling the truth. So somewhere in the middle of all this lies a scenario where £3,000 has gone missing. One of the crucial things here is that this was a highly unusual pattern on his account. It's not a pattern that's completely beyond the pale. Someone could conceivably be withdrawing that money. But I think maybe if there's an account that is effectively pretty much almost dormant, it's not being used, and then all of a sudden you do get a flurry of transactions, you'd like to think that your bank would somehow pick it up, that there would be some kind of method of flagging that to the bank. But obviously there wasn't.
I think one of the most important things people can do in something, let's take this case, for example, with the builder. Just transfer £1 over. Just phone the builder and say, can you just check your bank? I just want to make sure that I haven't typed in the wrong account number or done anything wrong. If it's a pound, you can live with it. If it's £20,000 and then you have to go through all the court and everything to try and get your money back, or you're not going to get your money back, you would have cursed and thought, God, if only I would have sent a pound first. I test the pound. That's what my top tip.
All right then, Lee. We'll keep up the good work. Thank you on our behalf. Coming up, fancy investing in cattle. We'll talk about that shortly. But first, let's focus on moving. Get it, Lee? Lee's not a big fan of that. Moogages didn't quite work. Sorry about that. But despite the Bank of England...
That would have been better. I preferred that.
Moogages, yeah. Well, we're talking about that because despite the Bank of England holding interest rates to a 300-year low, we're getting more warnings about how this is the last chance to grab a cheap mortgage. I know we've heard it all before, but really, this could be it. Apparently. Simon, what's going on?
Well, after the Bank of England base rate fell to its previous all-time low of 0.5% all those many years ago, and then banks decided a year or two later that maybe they would actually start lending out some mortgages again because they weren't so keen on that for a short while, interest rates came down substantially. And you're right, over that period of time we have had many a warning about it being your last chance to grab a cheap rate. And what has happened on many an occasion is that there has been a flurry to remortgage. Rates might have shifted up a little bit as banks and building societies anticipated that the Bank of England might raise interest rates. And then the threat disappeared away, money got even cheaper, and mortgages fell in cost. So on numerous occasions, you would have actually probably discovered that your mortgage would have been cheaper if you'd waited. However, that is not the way to think if you were looking at getting a mortgage, because they might get cheaper, but they also might get more expensive. And what you should really be looking at is it going to save you money? Am I fixing in for a decent period of time? And is this right for me? Now, that brings us on to the latest threat. Can you believe this one? Or are they just going to get cheaper still? Well, firstly, the one thing I would say, although it's been said before, mortgages are probably about as cheap as they're ever going to get right now. I mean,
give us an idea. What can you get?
Well, you could fix, if you've got a big deposit, you could fix your mortgage for 2 years below 1%. You could fix it for 5 years at just above 1.5%. Even if you've only got a 10% deposit, you can fix for 2 years below 2% and for 5 years at just below 3%. I mean, that's really, really, really cheap money. And what lies behind this really, really, really cheap money is not just the fact that the Bank of England decided to cut interest rates again a year ago down to 0.25%, but that the Bank of England also did something else at the same time. And it introduced a thing called the long-term funding scheme. And this was basically a little bit like our old friend Funding for Lending. And what this does is basically provides banks and building societies with cheap money that they can tap into from the Bank of England to lend out. So their costs of getting money to then pass on to borrowers and lend out to borrowers, or actually what really happens, it's slightly more complicated the way the banking system works, is that they can access this money, leave it sitting on their books or in their accounts in cash, that then enables them to create more money with that famous stroke of a pen or touch of a computer key, so they can create much, much more in mortgages. Essentially, it creates what was known as a carry trade. You get money at one low rate and you put it somewhere else at a higher rate. And that's what they've been doing with these mortgages. So the mortgages might be super cheap, but the cost of their funding is even cheaper than that. And the Bank of England's called time on this fella. It's decided that this emergency measure brought in the wake of the Brexit vote is no longer needed to be in place. And that means that the banks and building societies are not going to be able to continue to tap into this super, super, super cheap pipeline of money that enables them to lend out more money on mortgages, and could mean that you see mortgage rates go up even without the Bank of England raising interest rates. But couple it with the fact that people do think that the Bank of England might actually raise interest rates round about in the middle of next year, that if that actually comes to pass, and that is a big if, I mean, that's like, that if is bigger than the room that we're sat in, that if that actually comes to pass and interest rates go up, then mortgage rates will rise from the lows that they're at. Factor into that maybe banks being a tiny bit more cautious because stuff's looking a little bit not so rosy in the property market, and maybe some fears around Brexit, and you could find that mortgage rates go up. But they're not going to go up by a huge amount, I wouldn't suggest, without some kind of big event that suddenly drives them up. So basically, if you've got a mortgage that is on a higher rate than the mortgages than you can fix on at the moment, and you're not planning on moving anytime soon, then it makes perfect sense to go and see if you can get a cheaper mortgage. Go to thisismoney.co.uk/mortgage-finder, where you will find a calculator provided by our mortgage partner, L&C, that enables you to put in the value of your house, the mortgage amount that you need to borrow, press whether you want a two-year fix, a five-year fix, a tracker or whatever, and it will spit out the results that tell you what kind of rate you could get. And that's the kind of time spent that might end up saving you a couple of hundred quid a month, and that's a couple of hundred quid a month in your pocket or your bank account, not in your mortgage lenders. And that's always a move that's worth making.
All right. Interestingly, I just want to ask you quickly, Simon there said the housing market not looking too rosy. We're hearing some sort of rather downbeat noises about it at the moment. Also, Simon mentioned there about some big event happening. I was just thinking about getting a two-year fix. You'd be bang slap in the middle of Brexit, wouldn't you?
Well, look, I mean, it's a tough one, isn't it? And we had a story actually last week about the amount of people that have coming up for mortgage maturity. So people that have fixed in the past, they reckon that September and October is going to be the biggest, busiest time for remortgaging in sort of 5 years. It's quite tough to predict what's going to happen in the future. But as Simon rightly says, if you're not going to move, I really do think that a short-term or a mid-term fix is probably not a bad option.
All right, we're moving on from that. All right, no more cow jokes. But on your website, you do have a picture of a rather handsome cow. And the reason is that if you're someone who's ever fancied investing in cows, I mean, who hasn't? Coffee, yeah, maybe. And gold in the same place. Well, there's an ETF for that. Simon, that's amazing. What's an ETF?
An ETF is an exchange-traded fund, and it is a investment vehicle, a fund, that is traded on the stock market like a share. So whereas your traditional investment fund is run by a fund management company, it's priced twice a day. Mm-hmm. You can buy it on a daily basis, but the price doesn't change throughout the day. An ETF, the difference is that that is actually traded on the stock market.
Why?
As a normal share.
What's the point?
It gives you essentially live pricing on it. So, you know, for example, prices might change during the day. So originally these were tools that were used widely for trading, where people are moving in and out of positions quite rapidly, and the difference in price between the morning and the afternoon can make the difference between them making and losing money. But then people realised that these were also an easy way to pull together investments, perhaps in shares or commodities or bonds, into one easily tradable and cheap, above all, this is the main attraction of them, cheap investment fund. So in this one, which is a new ETF coming from iShares, this commodities ETF, you can invest in a basket of up to 24 of the world's most in-demand commodities with a annual fee of just 0.19%, which is pretty cheap.
Cows.
Cows. There's obviously a few crucial points to make out about this. Now, firstly, what this ETF does, as most ETFs do, is it tracks an index. And the index that it tracks is the Bloomberg Commodities Index. And this Bloomberg Commodities Index is actually tracking commodity futures. And commodity mm-hmm. futures are kind of derivatives traded on the commodities. And it bundles them all together. And the commodities that go into this index are weighted, which means there's more of them or less of them, on how much of those commodities are produced. This means that you could obviously end up getting a whacking great amount of one in there and less of others. So what they've done is they've put caps in on any one commodity, any one sector, any one derivative of a certain commodity, so that you don't end up with an ETF that's 95% oil and 5% all the other commodities. And if you want to invest in commodities, but you don't want to just invest in one commodity, for example, you don't just want to invest in oil, or you don't want to just invest in gold, or you don't just want to invest in live cattle, then this is a way of spreading it around a basket. And there is another point to make, which is that obviously it doesn't, because it uses these derivatives to mimic the price movements, it doesn't actually own any cows.
I'm sorry, when you said futures, all I can think of is you're not investing in cows, you're investing in frisky cows, right?
Yeah, futures,
that's,
frisky
I'm
cows.
Sorry,
yeah,
that's
yeah.
why I started to laugh.
You're not investing in cows of the future. You're investing in what people think will happen to the price of cows in the future. So yeah, you don't actually have to hold any live cattle, any lean hogs, any grains, any soybeans. I mean, I'd like to think that somewhere there's someone running an ETF who basically out the back has got some cows, some pigs, a couple of barrels of oil, maybe a small pile of gold and things like that. It's impractical to keep live cows. You need a farm yeah. and things like that. You can't just stash them in a room out the back of your out the back of your city office. So you do need to realise that. So it's not like it doesn't physically hold these assets. So there are some risks involved in that. The other thing to notice is that you should always do your research on these things. And one of the things that your research might throw up, if you look at the Bloomberg Commodities US Dollar Total Return Index and then drag that out over 5 years, is an alarming downward slope. basically over the last 5 years this index is down 41%. Now that alarming downward slope did sort of stop recently, and then it went up a little bit and then it went down a little bit. Over 1 year the index is up 0.33%, hardly a sparkling return, and in the year to date it's down 3.9%. So you do need to bear in mind that actually the return from commodities hasn't been brilliant. Now that would lead you to think one of two things. Either the return from commodities will continue to not be brilliant, but as we know, past performance is no guide to future gains, or commodities might be cheap at the moment. However, there is a concern, obviously, that if you just invest in a basket that includes all commodities, they might end up sort of cancelling each other out and you might not really go anywhere. One of the investment experts that we are in regular contact with from Seven Investment Management did actually send an email in after we published this saying that they considered commodities not to be an investment, but to be an anti-investment. Because the problem with commodities is that it costs you money to store them and they don't actually generate any income or anything like that. You're essentially speculating on the price of something. It's like the classic Warren Buffett thing about gold. He said, if you take a lump of gold and you bury it in the ground and you dig it up, it'll still be the same lump of gold. If you
don't
take
do
the
that
money,
with live cattle, for goodness sake.
Yeah, if you take the money that you would have invested in the gold and you put it into, and you bought a farm with it, that farm will continue to produce things, and so on and so on. So, look, these
Sorry,
commodities.
Simon.
Commodities are a high risk investment. Okay.
In sum, yeah. Okay. Then talking about creative investments, we've spoken in the past, haven't we, Simon, about cars fetching a bob or two, but I imagine not too many of them were category D. But trawl through car adverts, though, and invariably a few bargain motors will catch your eye, but they will often say Cat D next to them. Now, Simon, I'll be totally honest with you here. I had never heard of Cat D. You're probably not surprised. It sounds like a pop singer, doesn't it?
Cat no, it's D. Actually, it means the car's previously owned by Cat Deely.
Oh, there you go, then. See, if you'd said that with a straight face,
she's owned a lot of cars
and crashed them, because that's what that means, doesn't it? I'm not suggesting she has, by the way. But what is Cat D?
Cat D is a category given to crash-damaged cars. I'll read you out the definition here in full. A Cat D write-off is also fixable and at a repair cost lower than the car's market value. But the insurance company's decision to repair a vehicle like this will take into account other factors, such as the cost of a courtesy car whilst it's being mended and the cost of inspection fees to validate the completed repairs. In that case, the insurers might decide to write off a very lightly damaged car, selling it to an independent garage, which will then do the same repairs that the insurance company would have organised if it hadn't been written off. That garage will then sell it on to the public. So, let's take a real live example. Some years ago, I was enjoying dinner in my flat. It was a Sunday night. The doorbell rang. I opened the door. My neighbour was there in her dressing gown. I immediately knew something was up because she didn't always used to come round in her dressing gown.
Okay. One and one gave it away, Simon.
And she said, you need to come out. Somebody's hit your car. To which, in my mind, you know how you strangely compute things? I computed as in somebody's hit it, like punched it, and then run off or something. It's like, that's just
I'm
really
still distracted
weird.
By she didn't get changed before yeah. coming round to tell you. Yes. I mean, did that 5
well,
minutes matter?
So I came out. Well, you'll realise why in a minute. All I right. came outside, and my car was there, and the rear wheel had been sort of stoved in, pushed into the car. The side of it had been damaged. But then further down the road, in the middle of the road, was a car that had stopped with its airbags gone off, its hazard lights flashing, the door open, and basically the guy who had hit our car had hit it but kind of glanced off the side of it, shunted our car forward, continued on down the middle of the road, must have made an almighty noise, which is why my neighbour must have heard it, and then come to a halt in the middle of the road, and apparently a passerby had seen this. He got out of the car, stumbled out of the car, looked around to see if anybody had seen him in that sort of you ain't seen me right kind of way, and then just legged it. The upshot of this was obviously we had to make an insurance claim. Luckily, it turned out this guy basically had been drinking. The reason why he'd crashed was because he'd been driving down the road at high speed, down a narrow road, whilst leaning out the window being sick. We think he'd been drinking all day. There'd been a big football match on that afternoon as well. It was a number of coincidences going on. So anyway, we obviously had to make a claim on the insurer. Luckily, it wasn't on our insurer. It was on his insurer because the guy originally claimed his car had been stolen. The insurer said to him, when was the car stolen? Well, the police said, when was the car stolen? He said, yesterday afternoon. He reported it stolen on the Monday morning, to which the obvious response was, well, how do you know it's stolen on yesterday afternoon if you didn't find out till this morning? And actually, it was the insurance company that caught him out, his own insurance company. But anyway, we claimed off them, but they assessed our car and decided that our car was not worth fixing. There is a way of looking up at your old cars with the number plate, see if they're still on the road. And lo and behold, a few years back, I discovered that that car was actually still on the road. So the insurance company had decided it wasn't worth fixing and paying out the cost of repairs to us, but had then taken that car, written it off, given us the money, sold it onto a garage, then obviously fixed it up and then sold it on, and the car's still on the road.
So the insurance company get the money for selling cars that are effectively write-offs?
Yeah, so the insurance company passes it on to the garage. But anyway, the right. point is Sorry. That the Cat D cars are actually very, very, quite often very, very lightly damaged, because basically repairing a car nowadays can be very expensive for what would be a relatively minor dent in the side. I mean, this was an old Fiat Punto, right, that wasn't worth much money. But a big, expensive £10,000-£15,000 relatively modern car with a dent down three panels of the car they might decide to write that off, especially if they then factor in they're going to have to give you a courtesy car while it's in the body shop. They're going to have to go through all these other legal expenses and everything like that. So if
how much did you expect to buy that car for? That 15,000 one that you said that perhaps it was lightly damaged or a Cat D car.
Well, what you might find is that if you were looking at a car that would normally be worth £15,000 and you found a Cat D one, it would be maybe 13 or 12. The discounts aren't huge.
Yeah.
It's not like you're buying a car for a third of the price. So this is where the difficult decision comes in. There's an official process, should have been signed off, garage should have done the work properly. Do you trust all of that stuff? You should be able to trust it, but do you trust all of that stuff? Beyond that, do you think that when you come to sell on the car, because the next person who buys it is going to know it's a Category D, do you think that someone will buy it off you? So as long as you're happy with all of those things, then it's worth considering buying the car. But most people just see that and they immediately run a mile. But you do need to negotiate a decent discount. And I have seen many occasions when Cat D cars are on sale for what I would say is nowhere near enough of a discount.
I'm just taking a look here. You've got a step-by-step guide to buying a Cat D car, and you're going through it. Buy from a dealer rather than a private seller. Ask plenty of questions. Have an inspection done. Invest in a history check. And I get all the way to the bottom. I think, yeah, I'm all sorted, Simon. And then it says, Cat N car.
Yes. Well, what's going to make this slightly more complicated is that from October 2017, the current A, B, C and D categories will be replaced by new A, B, S and N categories.
Naturally.
That, according to the Association of British Insurers, reflect the increasing complexity of newer vehicles, which can make it harder for damaged cars to be safely repaired. The updated system concentrates more on the condition of the car rather than the cost of repair. So Category N, or non-structural cars, are equivalent to Cat D. Their damage isn't to the core structure, but there might still be some safety-related parts in areas like suspension or steering that will need to be replaced.
All right, then, we'll get on to top 10 hybrid cars shortly. But first, perhaps you have a nice little learner on the side, perhaps doing up Cat D cars and selling them on. I think you might be able to just put through some of your income. Think again. HMRC probably has a good idea of how much you earn. Now, Lee, you spoke to Richard Morley, partner at accountancy and tax consultants BDO, over 25 years of tax experience, knows what he's talking about, and he's busted a few tax return myths and told you what we need to know about declaring your full income to the tax man.
Yeah, that's right. So he's given us three myths about, you know, people that choose to perhaps not declare all of their income if they're self-employed. And the number one thing is, of course, what I think a lot of people probably do think in this category, is that the HMRC has no way of finding out my real income. Because people probably do think, well, HMRC hasn't got time to go through every single person in Britain's self-employed status and knowing every single penny that I'm getting in. But what he's arguing is that actually they've really cracked down on this. So in 2011, there's 140 task force that the tax man sort of set on people. And I remember writing about it at the time. And actually, since then, they've managed to collect an extra 500 million people from people that hadn't declared certain parts of their income. We have this argument all the time, why are they going after the individuals all the time and why are they not going after these big companies? But that's a tactic that they believe was a soft touch that they could sort of investigate and get money back from.
How many people did you say it had done? 50 million?
500 million pounds.
Oh, pounds.
Sorry, yeah, 500 million pounds. That's how much the task force have sort of managed to rake in extra since they started in 2011.
It's not corporate billions, is it, though?
It's not corporate billions, and that's what people, you know, they do get their backs up about it, don't they? Because it's kind of like, why are you going after the little guy and not going after the bigger firms? Number two, I haven't heard anything from the tax man in 10 years. I must be safe now. So he says it's true that when a person makes an honest mistake in their tax return, HMRC has a limited time frame of 4 years to access any unpaid tax. It has 6 years to issue assessments for a tax year in which careless errors were made. However, it can look back and assess tax for the previous 20 years where a person deliberately evades tax or if they fail to notify HMRC that they need to submit a tax return without a reasonable excuse. So basically, what that's saying is that it's not true. They can go back quite a long way. And if you have been on the fiddle, not doing things properly for a long time, they have the power to go back all that time and perhaps fine you and claw back that tax, which would be pretty horrific, I'd imagine, for many people. And then the last one is that never told the tax man I'm self-employed, so I don't need to. What's the point? There's been this whole argument in the last couple of years, isn't there, that HMRC is trying to sort of access people's statements. It's almost becoming a bit of a big brother sort of nation in that respect, and that's why a lot of stuff's going towards sort of digital money rather than, you know, cash and the death of cash and all of that sort of stuff. But he's saying that, you know, that it's got more and more data than ever before, you know, because a lot of things are becoming computerized, and it's more likely to discover anyone who is yet to be caught, which sounds really quite ominous and quite scary. But if you're someone that is self-employed or, you know, has a business, the likely, if you're acting in the correct way, you're not doing anything sort of illegally, then you've got nothing to worry about. And this article is just all common sense, and you'll just go, all right.
Well, I don't know about that, Lee. I do still think that people who do things properly and the like still get caught out in some way. I think it's so confusing for people.
Tax.
I mean, I got a bill the other day. You owe us 150 quid. There's no way of me checking that. So you just write, oh, here you go, have a check and be off
and
with
then,
you.
And then next year they'll owe you 150 quid.
Well, you just can't work it out exactly. It's just too confusing. Simon?
Well, my wife is in this position. I mean, she started up her own business two years ago, and she has an accountant that she pays by. I mean, she's paying the accountant like 60 or 70 quid a month. It's a lot of money. And she's doing that because she's not quite confident, especially once you start introducing things like VAT into the equation, claiming back your expenses and stuff like that. But there's a brilliant comment exchange here on the bottom of this article. A person calling themselves Solution in Chichester. Self-employed bank accounts should have a system in place which automatically deducts a percentage of tax each time income is paid into it, starting once you reach your tax-free allowance. At the end of the year, all you would submit is a reclaim figure of your expenses, and this would be put back into your account. So rather than panicking at Christmas time in July, when you usually have to pay your tax, you would instead be getting a refund for expenses around this time. You'd still keep up good records up together in case of inspection. In addition to this, brackets, and this may be controversial, when it comes to the end of the year, the taxman refunds 1 month's worth of income back to self-employed, in the same way those on PAYE get a month's paid holiday each year. To which another commenter, calling themselves Willem Deleu in Winchester, replies, "That would be easy to game. Simply open lots of bank accounts. Your holiday pay idea is mad."
Fair enough.
I think somewhere between those two comments lies the answer.
Very good. All right, then, I'm going to ask you, we're going to move on from this. What do you collect? For me, it is football programmes of games I've been to, indeed any sporting events I've been to. Simon, for you, what do you collect? Anything?
I don't really have a proper collection as such. I have a large music collection. I have a large record collection. Things I always keep hold of, though, are gig tickets and stuff like that. They all get pinned to the pinboard in our kitchen. It's just covered in gig tickets and event tickets and stuff like that.
At least you're showing them off. Mine just is in some
drawer
somewhere.
Yeah, but it's not really a collection that's going to be building up any value, so
you never
to speak.
Know.
So I guess the thing I would say is probably my record collection.
All right, then. Now, I know what Lee has, and Lee, I'll be totally honest with you, I was not enormously surprised when I found out that you have a stamp collection gathering.
What does that mean?
Little Lee, who dreamt of being the state agent with his stamp collector. Where was the praise in that, Simon? So when the chance to get it valued, though, Lee, came up and see if you were a stamp millionaire, it was just too good to be missed, wasn't it? Wasn't it?
Right.
So you've been delving in the world of, and please tell me how you pronounce
this. No, I'm not going to.
I've annoyed you now. Philatelist?
That sounds good.
Right, the fact you're sitting opposite me makes me think you're not a millionaire. but go on, defend yourself, Lee. Tell us the truth.
Well, first of all, let's rewind a little bit here,
right,
Georgie. This is a collection that I have, but I didn't put together. I remember once my dad, who was an avid stamp collector, don't ask me why.
My dad's a train spotter, it's fine.
My dad was also a train spotter, it's a double whammy. and you really wouldn't think it. I don't know why. He's just like, he's quite a cool dad, but if somebody loves stamps, he loves train spotting. I've got no idea why. Or actually, what this stamp expert told me that came around and valued the collection is that in the 1950s and 60s, where things like stamp collecting and train spotting were really popular, and which is, my dad was born in 1949, so he falls right into that category, there wasn't a lot to do. Which is fair enough, isn't it? I loved it. No, so he was saying pretty much half of young Britons, especially boys, had some sort of stamp collection in the 40s, 50s, 60s, because there was nothing to do. Instead of taking selfies on their phones or going on Twitter, they had collections. And for that reason, there's a lot of people that inherit collections, like myself, who, you know, Dad gave me his collection of stamps. And a lot of people, I reckon, are in the same boat that have been given these stamps. Now, the likelihood is probably 99.9% of these stamps are worth nothing, but there's always that little inkling feeling, isn't there, Georgie? You might have gold. You might have one stamp that's rare, or there's something in there that's worth an absolute fortune. You know, we occasionally watch these programmes or snatch a bit of watching an Antiques Roadshow or something like that, and you think, there might be... There just might be.
And?
Something, no.
No. Maybe like a fiver or something?
Unfortunately not. The stamps that my dad collected were from the Pitcairn Islands. Really quite a random little place. Population of 50 people. It's a British Overseas Territory. It is just in the middle of the Pacific. It's just like, you know, nothing around it. And they started issuing stamps in the 40s. For some reason, my dad sort of decided that he liked the stamps and collected them, become part of the collecting club. And built this collection together. Now, what happened was, people that came around to value this are doing a show next month in Islington. So you can go and take your collection along there and they'll value it for free for you. So I said, come along. I don't know what they're worth, but it'd be nice for you just to finally put a value on. So he said that, you know, they're worth £100 rather than thousands of pounds, which is fine. It's still nice to know that it has some sort of value. I'll obviously keep hold of it for now. But he did give me some examples over the years. I mean, he's been doing this for 60-odd years. And for example, someone came into the office, almost sold this collection for £50, get rid of it. Anyway, they had a look through an expert, and their eye got caught by this 1850 stamp. There was only other two others in existence. One was in the Royal Collection, one was in the Royal Mint Heritage Collection. So they obviously got very excited about this stamp. Mm-hmm. And he went into all the details about it. It was actually a trial stamp to see how Albert's face would look on a stamp instead of Victoria's. So they're very, 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 very rare. And they sold it for £40,000 at auction. And then a decade later, so this was a little while ago, our expert, Mr. Warren, saw it listed at another dealer for £175,000. So it had obviously grown in value over that time. So there are success stories. As he says, it is like finding a needle in a haystack. And I don't envy people that do value stamps, because that finding a needle in a haystack does not sound like an interesting job to me.
Yeah. If anybody wants some Wimbledon programmes circa sort of 1992...
It might be worth a bit of cash, seeing as they went...
tons.
Have you had them value, George? Have you had a look on eBay or anything?
No, I've not. I've not looked in my mum's attic since I left them there. Anyway, let's move on from that. Thank you very much there, Lee. I did promise that following on from our extensive coverage of the new petrol diesel ban coming in, listen to Podcast Past, I think it was about 2 weeks ago, wasn't it? On your website, you have the 10 best hybrid cars on sale today, from sports car performance to family SUV and everyday hatchback. Firstly, Simon, what is a hybrid?
A hybrid car... is a car that is powered by either petrol or diesel, with also some electric power. These come in a variety of different forms. Some of them you can spend some time just driving around on the electric and the petrol or diesel kicks in when you need it. But a lot of the time, the electric is supplementing the petrol and diesel. And what these are, crucially, is something that is not going to be banned in 2040. So you might find that by 2040, the car industry has got its game together. Likely. Mm-hmm. You might even find the government has got its game together. Unlikely. Mm-hmm. And that we are only driving around in electric cars. Or you might find that we're still driving around, that we're driving around in hybrids. But anyway, these are the ones you can buy now. And there's some pretty good ones out there. And we've got 10 of the best. And they range from the Toyota Yaris Hybrid, smaller than a Prius. Everyone will know the Prius.
Simon,
if they've ever got a minicab or an Uber somewhere.
Just a quick one. How do you vote for the 10 best?
Ah, well, you see... this.
Now, I'm assuming there's no sort of backhander kind of things going on here, because, you know, this is money.
How dare you, Georgie? What did you take us for?
I said I assume it's not happening. So,
we didn't just have a show of hands around the desk. Yeah. Anyone want to name their favourite hybrid? And everyone went, I've been in a Prius. Rob, our motoring reporter, said I've been in lots of them. And Lee said, I've been in a Mitsubishi Outlander, PHEV. Also, whilst we run a successful motoring section and have a motoring reporter in Rob Hull, we don't have the resources to do endless testing of cars and be out there just driving cars around all day, see if they're any good. But our friends over at What Car helped us with this one. So we have expert car testers. This is their 10 of the best. So we've got the Yaris. That's just a small hybrid, little hatchback. At the other end of this, we've got the Mitsubishi Outlander PHEV. It's a large SUV-style 4x4 type car. Very, very popular. the most popular hybrid in the UK, priced from £31,805. You get a Mercedes C-Class, and you can also get, effectively, a high-end sports car, the equivalent of a supercar. You can get the BMW i8, which is a very swoopy-looking BMW coupe, very futuristic-looking, rave reviews when it came out, £106,000 that one will set you back, and that's basically your alternative to a Porsche 911.
£106,000.
Yeah, but it's kind of a rival to a 911 or something. You know, it's an expensive car for people who can buy expensive cars.
It's all right, Georgie.
Can you get for that?
You can get one for a £200 deposit and just a 7-year leasing contract.
Yeah, now at the other end of the BMW scale, you've got the BMW i3. And this is a much smaller hybrid car. Looks very futuristic. You will have seen them on the streets. Looks quite sort of smaller, chunkier, quite futuristic, like something you'd see driving around in a sci-fi movie. Again, have been quite popular, but it's only got the full electric model you can get has a range of only 124 miles, which is why lots of people will buy the hybrids, because they can go further. And the Golf GTE... this is one that I'm seeing more and more and more of on the road, actually. Everybody loves a Golf. Everybody loves a Golf GTI. Mm-hmm. The GTE combines the hot hatch styling and performance of a normal Golf with the ability to have an all-electric range of about 30 miles and emissions of only 39 grams per kilometre of CO2. So it's a very clean car. Basically, these are the cars of the future. We should substantially reduce emissions. However, there are claims made about fuel economy and things like that that often don't stack up in the real world.
Which one gets your vote, Simon?
My vote? Mm-hmm. I quite fancy a BMW i8, actually.
Lee, you?
Well, look, you know, i8 is pretty nice, but I have been in the Outlander. I've driven it. It's very nice. I think they're good cars.
Yeah, I'm going to go with what you say there, Lee.
Yeah. Yeah, okay, Georgie. Thanks.
Yeah, just because I'm none the wiser. Editor Simon Lambert and Consumer Affairs Editor Lee Boyce. Don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk. Follow us on Twitter or download the app. And if you like the podcast, please do rate us on iTunes. It all helps.